haired weirdos, short haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
Hey, Jay, how are you doing this morning?
I'm pretty good. Pretty good. Nothing witty. It was one of those
weeks.
It was a long week. The defending freedom,
but it is a thankless and exhausting task sometime, I am sure. Well, we have an awful lot to get to this week. You know, Jay, I was just saying before we hit record that there was a time when August in politics used to be called the silly season because there was so little of import going on that just weird things would come up. And I got to say, it still feels like the silly season and that weird things are coming up, but they're incredibly important weird things that are coming up. And so we're going to be covering all of those things, well, as many of them as we can. So, for instance, the appointment of a special counsel in the Hunter Biden case, Ohio's issue one and what that means about abortion rights and the 2024 elections. Further developments in the Trump indictments, President Biden requesting more money for Ukraine and whether that's going to go through, and a bunch of other things. We'll see as much as we can get to as we can. And so, but before we do get to that, I wanted to start with a brief update. Recently, one of our listeners raised a question about a story that May and I discussed. It was in early July. And this is about why a number of Republican-led states have been pulling out of ERIC, which is that multi-state compact that checks for duplicate and inaccurate voter registration, as well as helps to register voters. And the question was about May's claim that ERIC was, in her words, founded by George Soros money, and that Soros is well known for his support for liberal causes. And that's not exactly untrue, but I think it may give people the wrong impression. Here's what I mean. The Soros connection is that the Pew Charitable Trust is an organization that helped to develop ERIC, and the Soros-funded Open Society Foundation has donated to Pew. And so there's kind of an indirect thing there, but saying it's Soros-funded or founded, that's not really correct. But pulling back from that, kind of more central to May's argument, I think, was that a guy named David Becker, who's a Democratic activist, was a founder and a board member of ERIC, and he's tried to move the direction to the left. And that is definitely correct. And so I think you can pull that part of May's argument aside and say, well, yeah, that's not maybe correct or it's misleading, while still saying that her general argument about why states on the right are pulling out of ERIC is still makes sense. I don't agree with it, certainly, but I don't think it necessarily invalidates the rest of her argument. But it was a fair point that a listener made, and I just wanted to bring that up. So there you go. All right. So on Friday, just yesterday, Attorney General Merrick Garland appointed U.S. Attorney David Weiss special counsel in the investigation of Hunter Biden. And on the same day, federal prosecutors announced that they haven't been able to work out a plea deal with Biden after that deal fell apart last month when the judge it came before questioned her authority to actually enforce the agreement. And so this means that there are three unresolved charges against Biden, two misdemeanor tax charges and the felony firearms offense. Now, Weiss, who was nominated to be U.S. attorney in 2018 in Delaware by Donald Trump, he's been in charge of the Biden investigation since it started in 2019. Now, Weiss apparently requested that he be given special counsel status, and Garland said that given the extraordinary circumstances of the case, he concluded that doing so was at this point in the public interest. Now, you might remember that this comes after congressional testimony back in May, in which two criminal investigators working on the Biden case said that Weiss had been blocked from bringing charges against Biden by higher-ups and that he'd asked for special counsel status for greater independence, but that had been rejected. Now, these are both charges that Weiss has denied. And in the announcement of appointing Weiss as special counsel, Garland said, "This appointment confirms my commitment to provide Mr. Weiss all the resources he requests. It also reaffirms that Mr. Weiss has the authority he needs to conduct a thorough investigation and to continue to take the steps he deems appropriate independently based on only on the facts and the law. So, Jay, what do you think about this latest development in the Hunter Biden case?
So I've got a couple thoughts. And again, it's doing sort of hot takes, right? Because this just happened yesterday. And we haven't seen, I think, the full reporting. And it's always, you know, curious when these things hit on a Friday. Look, my sense is it seems warranted. It seems appropriate. It seems to be the right move politically for everybody involved. So I think that's the right thing to do. Also, I think it's a matter of they were down to what choice did they have, right? With the plea deal fell apart. And there was not going to be any plea deal on that, absent this, you know, with the government saying, you know, we can't commit to the full immunity, which I think my read of the plea deal had been before that there was sort of a nod and a wink type thing of look, yeah, the investigation's ongoing, but not really. This sort of puts them in the position of, okay, if there isn't an ongoing investigation, then they need to have an ongoing investigation. So I think that's fine. The double-edged sword part of it is, if you're a Republican, is now there's an ongoing investigation, which frees up a lot of these witnesses that the weaponization committee and other congressional committees might call to say, look, I can't comment because there's an ongoing investigation. So I think, you know, Republicans could look at this as a double-edged sword. I think it's generally a good thing, you know, that Merrick Garland's being sort of held to his word now. And if there was a question of whether he was blocking the authority of Weiss before, he's now sort of made those questions moot. So that's why, I mean, I think it works politically for everybody involved. Now, it's still a bad fact for President Biden, who I think would have liked to have said, hey, there was a plea deal. It's all done. It's all wrapped up. Case closed. But now we'll be unable to do so.
Yeah, I think that in reality, this or on the ground, this doesn't really change anything. I mean, if you take Garland and Weiss at their word, saying that, because Garland has for a long time now been saying that Weiss is in effect operating independently. He's not getting that day-to-day supervision. And so he was, for all intents and purposes, again, if you believe what Garland and Weiss were saying, operating as sort of an independent counsel without the formal authority. And so you might as well give him the formal authority. But yeah, this, you know, what this means, I guess, is under the special counsel, that's an older term. Under the special counsel statute, it means that the attorney general can only veto any of Weiss's actions, anything he wants to do, bring charges, if he concludes that the action is so inappropriate or unwarranted under departmental practices, it shouldn't be pursued. That's a pretty high bar to get across. And also, he can only fire a special counsel for cause, so malfeasance, incompetence, that sort of thing. And yeah, honestly, I don't think this is, I think you're right. In terms of the optics, they felt that, well, what else can we do? I don't think it really matters, because unless Hunter Biden is found guilty of 38 counts of whatever and sentenced to be, I don't know, life in prison, I don't think that the Republican charges of politicized justice system going after Trump and not after Biden, I don't think that's going to change anything, really, is my sense.
Oh, I think those claims, well, still would still exist on the politicization of the justice system. What's bigger, of course, what's more important for the Republicans is not and has never been whether Hunter Biden is prosecuted over drug charges or getting a gun while under disability. It's the what was the big guy up to and you know, the 10%. So, I mean, that's the much bigger question. Now, I think what you'll see is as the House committee continues to try and investigate President Biden and the broader Biden family, you will now get the response of, well, this probe is all being handled by the special counsel, where I'm not sure that it is.
Right? No, I don't think so. No, I think
the special counsel authority is limited to Hunter. In some cases, majority of the big cases that might have been made against Hunter, tax evasion, for example, have the statute of limitations is run. So we'll see. I mean, it could be. Here's the other thing that's of course strange that, look, as you say, if he's been he's been acting as essentially a special counsel for, 4 years now, 5 years, probably not that long, right?
Since 2019, yeah. So it's been a while.
Four years. It seems unlikely that there's going to be new information that comes up. Although there was certainly, these witnesses have pointed out that, hey, there were witnesses they wanted to interview, but they claimed they were blocked from doing so, et cetera. So I don't know whether that changes that, whether we go back and talk to those witnesses now, or at this point, those witnesses' testimony may have become moot with the passage of time. But we'll see.
Last week, when May and I were talking about the other special counsel, Jack Smith, we were saying May made the point that, special counsels, special counsels, they tend to be fairly aggressive, kind of hard charging people. Right. And so you would think, especially given the fact that Weiss is no like partisan Democratic hack. Right. He was appointed U.S. attorney by Donald Trump, that if there is something there that is within his authority to prosecute, he would want to do that, right? Just like Jack Smith would want to do that. And so that's why, to me, this whole sort of, at first it was the talking point, if you will, was, Weiss is being stopped from doing these things. And now I wonder if it shifts to, Weiss doesn't want to do these things. I think it becomes really problematic when you start to question every single special counsel, basically saying, the refs are obviously fixed in this sort of thing, and that's why we're not getting the result we want. Well, maybe in the Hunter Biden case, there's just not a whole lot there, at least on the specific Hunter Biden charges. Now, I agree with you. It's a different story with the sort of stuff that the Biden family group is working on in the House, right? Now, that's obviously a partisan committee, but I've said all along that it seems to me—
Doesn't mean they're wrong.
No, it seems to me clear— that Hunter Biden is a sleazy guy who traded on his dad's name. The larger question is, was his dad in any way involved in that? Or was he just saying, the big guy will get 10% and the big guy had no idea about that sort of thing? And that's a legitimate question. I would think anyone would want that question answered as definitively as we can. I don't think that's going to be.
I don't know if anyone would want an answer.
Any intellectually honest person who cares about the truth would want that. You and I both would want that. Okay, so there we go. All right. Well,
so I would bring up, though, there's another danger, of course, in this. And that is, as you pointed out, May pointed out, special counsels tend to be, that's why you hire them, right? They're aggressive, hard charging, go get them type people. And also there's a certain, even though the special counsel statute is different than the independent counsel statute, there's a certain, fun in that you kind of get to be your own boss, you get to have your own budget, and you get to sort of have the job for as long as you like, right? More or less. So assuming he moves forward and says, aha, there are a number of new things that we've uncovered in other charges that we're going to bring, or even just other areas we're going to investigate. That raises a troubling question for Merrick Garland and the Justice Department is, why didn't you do this before?
Right. If that actually is the case and he finds more things, that sort of thing. Yeah, absolutely. But that remains to be seen.
What I'm saying is if he finds more things to investigate or takes investigative steps that he didn't take before.
Sure. Yeah.
One could infer from that he was unable to take those steps before.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah. And certainly if that's the case, that will raise additional questions. And if that does happen, we'll definitely be talking about it. Okay, well, let's move on to something very different. On Tuesday, not quite a week ago, Ohio voters, pretty resoundingly, I would
say. That's you and me, Mike.
Yeah, that's right. We are Ohio voters. Most of the hosts are, in fact, on the show. But anyway, we, not you, but, you know, we in general rejected a proposal that would have raised the bar for state constitutional amendments from a majority to 60%, as well as applying sort of more stringent signature requirements to get proposed amendments on the ballot in the first place. Now, in his comments on the result, which was rejected by 57% of voters, Ohio Governor Mike DeWine said, look, when something passes with that kind of margin, when you win with that kind of majority, don't fault the campaign, don't fault your strategy. It just wasn't going to happen. Now, last week, May and I discussed this kind of, but we focused mainly on whether or not state constitutions are too easy to amend, and I brought up whether the U.S. Constitution is too difficult to amend. But this week, we're going to focus on the actual policy issue involved. And when I say the policy issue, I don't mean requirements to alter the state constitution. That was, of course, ostensibly what it was about. But as I mentioned last week, this only came about in the first place because of the upcoming November vote on enshrining abortion rights in the Ohio Constitution. And had last week's amendment passed, it would have meant that 60% of voters would have had to approve the abortion amendment, whereas now it's only going to require a majority, which is how it's been in Ohio for like the last century. And what we know is that okay, a lot can happen between now and whatever, the first Tuesday in November. Polling, I think, suggests it's very likely that the abortion amendment will pass in Ohio, just like similar abortion amendments or laws have passed in a bunch of other conservative states, which in the wake of Dobbs, voters have had the opportunity to have some sort of a direct say. And I noted that following the Ohio result, the Wall Street Journal's editorial board said, you know, Republicans have not been able to successfully engage voters on this issue. And in their words, this political liability will persist until the GOP finds an abortion message that most voters can accept. So, Jay, I wanted to get your thoughts both on the Ohio vote specifically and kind of the broader implications for abortion rights and the Republican Party going forward.
So a couple different things. And here I'm going to get into the weeds, and you can probably comment on this as a political scientist. As again, you can actually bring the actual science to it, whereas I will just, you know, bring my gut sense and emotion. And yeah, I'd be the Captain Kirk to your Mr. Spock, as it were. But I think part of the problem with issue one in Ohio was just structural, right? There were a whole lot of reasons why this was never going to win. And I would have, you know, the 60-40 outcome is more or less what I would have predicted. And those structural problems include, but are not limited to, one, you've got the you're trying to win the yes side on any amendment, on a constitutional amendment. I'm sure you probably have numbers on this, Mike. My gut sense number is that anytime you're trying to win the yes side, you can kind of spot the other team 10 points.
Maybe not 10, but your general argument, yeah, that the no has sort of a built-in advantage out the gate, I think is correct. Yeah. And there's, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So that's one. Secondly, you're doing this in a special election, which is weird. And which quite honestly, a lot of Republicans, had made, points about earlier, saying we ought not to have these, August special elections. Cause what usually happens, it's usually some sort of tax levy that gets put on. And the supporters show up and no one else even, you know, who wasn't paying attention knew that there was an election. So there is an irony and some could say hypocrisy, among Ohio Republicans who had in the past said, hey, we don't like August elections. But we like this one.
Like the Secretary of State he's the person I'm thinking of particularly who said, I think back in 2020 that we shouldn't do these things. They cost money and they're sneaky basically. But well, yeah, if it costs money, yeah, it's sneaky for our cause. It's a different story. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and the other point being, So, but you know, you're sort of left with no choice. And this is, this I think is one of these deals where, not even the wisest of us can see all ends, right? You could say if you were really smart, you would have figured this out that, okay, the court's going to overturn Dobbs and that'll happen. And then this will happen and this will happen. And then we'll put this in place. But we didn't, you know, no one was thinking five moves ahead.
No, not like that.
Almost no one, you know, I might count myself, So what we were left, you know, what Republicans were left with was like, you know, we'll surprise the pro-abortion folks want to get a piece on the ballot. What do we do about it? So the next piece of this, which I think is, this is where the strategy gets interesting, is this a, if, oh, the other reason you're going to lose just structurally is you're asking voters to limit their own authority, right? It's just an easy, you know, there's the other side gets the, hey, they're taking away your rights. Card to play. Again, that's hard to overcome, especially if it's a yes, no. All you got to do to win the no is just generate enough doubt of, you know, would you like, you know, things to, there's a scene on The Office of, you know, would you like, Michael Scott asks, would you like your life to be much better, immediately better or worse, or remain the same? Like, remain the same. And I think there's something to that in voting is, you know, you're like, well, all right, well, it's, things are going okay so far. I would, you know, let's not make any radical changes. And that's actually a, you know, obviously a conservative type impulse of let's not go changing, you know, don't go changing the Constitution unless you have to. All that said, I would agree with, I think, where you and Mayor were last time, the Ohio Constitution. And other constitutions like it, which can be amended by a bare majority, have in recent years, and that's probably the last 20 years, fallen victim to special interests, you know, sort of rent seeking in the Constitution. We have, you know, a constitutional provision that talks about the size of gaming tables. It establishes, you know, constitutional franchises for certain casinos. It, you know, there are a lot of these pieces that ought not to be in a constitution. You can argue they could be statutory, something like that, or even on this is the stuff, the minutia that ought to be taken care of by the regulatory state. But there we are, and that's the flaw is that in that is that it really doesn't cost you anything more to get something put in the constitution than it does just to get it enacted as a statute by initiative. So anyway, I would have, you know, been, I was for raising the bar, you know, abortion notwithstanding, for years. So then my last other point, the other reason I think you, people lose on this, is it's sort of a complicated issue a little bit, right? You've got to, it takes a couple sentences to explain what it is you want, if you're on the yes side. What it is you want to do and why you want to do it.
I see.
It's what we want to raise the limit. Well, why? Well, because it's special interest. And then you get you know buried in that is of course the hypocrisy of, well, no, it's really about abortion. So anyway, that's my reason of, like, there were about a dozen reasons why this was going to fail.
But it seems to me that on the abortion policy issue, that certainly maybe gets to your point about Republicans not really being able to, and maybe fairly so, not being able to see five moves ahead. They clearly have not, and I agree with the Wall Street Journal's editorial board here, they clearly have not been able to figure out a popular strategy for dealing with the energy and engagement of moderate voters who might otherwise be, you know, go vote Republican, saying no on this particular issue. That it seems to me that the activists in the Republican Party are far more extreme than the median voter is, and that has the potential to really hurt voters, not just in you know, kind of purple states, but I mean, you know, Kentucky, voters by a majority protected abortion rights, Montana voters, Kansas voters. And so these are solid Trump states. And I think that the Republican Party has to find a way to somehow create some distance. I don't think the idea that, well, we just don't have a good enough argument. I mean, I think people's views on abortion are pretty settled. They just need to find a way to kind of do some kind of a carve out or something, because this is an electoral loser for Republicans. It seems very clear to me.
It is, as it's currently situated. So here's the next part of my analysis is the question, is this a fight you had to have? Is this a battle you had to fight but lose? And I think it probably was for those very reasons. If you're an Ohio Republican, one, you have to be able to say, hey, we gave it a try. Secondly, you lay the groundwork for the no vote on the next issue by means of, you know, the anti-issue one folks ran a campaign mainly on. This is gutting the Ohio Constitution and, you know, removing your constitutional rights. And the bizarre claim of this one person, one vote, which to me is still sort of nonsensical, because one person, one vote, it wouldn't change. You would just need more of those people or more of those votes. But notwithstanding the bad math, there, I think when this issue comes up in November, there may be a good number of people who were either on the fence or no voters. When this is about abortion, we're like, wait, what? that's what this was trying to do. And I think the message that Republicans can have, right? And this is, I think, an important thing in what's happened in the post-Dobbs world, is it's a whole lot easier to play defense than to play offense. And I think in a lot of cases, Republicans overplayed their hand on offense on this issue. So they didn't get to, for years while Roe, Casey, et cetera, were all in place, Republicans had sort of a free hand in that they could enact whatever abortion policy they wanted to if they had the majority, sort of safely knowing
that
it's never actually going to come into fruition because of the
court. Oh, crap, it's law now. We didn't expect that. Yeah.
Yeah. And now all of a sudden, you know, for example, so we had Ohio had this heartbeat bill, which would effectively ban abortion after about 6 weeks or so. Which is on the far side, you know, by comparison, the Mississippi case in Dobbs was, I want to say 20 weeks, 15 weeks, something like that.
But your larger point, right, being that this was in the past, you've talked about what you call free votes. And if you know something is not going to actually go into effect, then you can be freer to just kind of say or do whatever. And now all of a sudden, all of those Ohio Republicans who said, yes, let's pass this super restrictive thing to placate the people on our far right where all the energy is. Now it's law, or would be law if, you know, there hadn't been a court ruling. Now all of a sudden, well, that complicates things a whole lot. Exactly.
Yeah,
definitely.
So it's more difficult to put, because I think the place where, and the polls show this consistently, right? The place where most Americans are on abortion is they don't like it, but they don't want an absolute ban.
Safe, rare,
right?
But legal.
And,
yeah. I mean,
exactly. So I think a lot of cases, if you had something that was, say, and this is what this is just my nostalgia, but, you know, what we did in the 90s, where we came out with one of the first partial birth abortion bans in the country. We're there. I think there was an easy political case to make. Say, listen, this is, you know, barbaric, these late term abortions, and it's in most cases unnecessary. And then when it is medically necessary, it can be medically necessary, and you can write those protections into the statute. Devil's in the details and the drafting on that, right? But you can, you know, it's a drafting problem, right? It's not a philosophical problem, Yeah, because that's my sense is where most Americans would be, that they would say, well, 6 weeks sure sounds too early.
You know, but 8.5 months is too late unless there's a reason. Sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So and you know, for this kind of decision, regardless of where you are on the issue, right? from a agnostic process standpoint, that's the way it ought to be hammered out, right? You know, you're going to have people on either side who don't love the outcome, but you'll probably have something that most people can live with. And I said before, I think that's where we eventually end up. It's just going to be a couple back and forths. And in the recent couple times, it's been the Republicans who are on offense trying to charge up the hill. And that's tougher. Now, when we turn this into November, Republicans will be playing defense. And I think there's going to be some good defensive points to be making, right?
See, I disagree with you. I agree with you up to there, but I think you're entirely wrong on that, because I see it actually as an argument about what where Republicans are still on offense, because what they're arguing for is, should this thing that changes the regime we've been under, that puts significant restrictions on women's reproductive or abortion rights, should this change go into effect? Because it actually does change the status quo. And so that means you're arguing for a change that restricts rights. And given what we've seen in Kentucky, Montana, Vermont, Kansas, every place, literally every place it's been put up to a citizen vote, it's voters have rejected that restriction of rights. I don't see that there's much of a chance of it happening in Ohio either.
Yeah, but I would say it, at least as far as the Ohio version goes, when it comes down to what box are you checking, it's going to be no. And if I'm a pro-life Republican, or just a pro-life person generally, and I'm running, working on this issue, I think the message is, listen, they're telling, the other side is telling you that this is about just codifying Roe versus Wade, right? This is just about expanding the time beyond 6 weeks. But what it's really about is taking steps that are far, far beyond anything that was in place under the judicial regime, if you will, right?
You see, already though, you're getting into an argument that you can't fit into a soundbite, which is why I think other reasons that your side is going to lose on this. And I think, rightly so. Your side, I mean, just
I'm just not trying.
Side.
No, this is an extremist campaign by out of state, big money, left wing folks who want to turn your kids into drag queens.
Well, sure, that's going to preach to the choir, but the moderates, I think, the same sort of arguments were tried, like I said, in Kansas and Kentucky and Montana and other states. Those arguments failed for good reason, and they're going to fail in Ohio. This amendment's going to pass with at least 5%.
In those states, were they playing defense or offense? Were they on the no side or the yes side?
I couldn't tell you offhand.
Yeah, but I think most of those were again Republicans having to either, promote either legislation or get something enacted. Right?
We'll see in November. In November. But I feel very confident that you're wrong on this one. But we'll see in November. Right. So,
and we've talked about this a lot. But I am a big one in this case. I do trust a lot to just the structural, parts of this, right? That I think defending the no side is a lot easier. I think when you're in a bigger turnout election, it's going to change things a little bit. And here's my soundbite is, do you want universal abortion in Ohio? Yes or no?
Yeah, except that's not how it's going to be framed to plenty of people. Like I said, I understand that in your world this is a compelling argument.
I would argue that's the actual import of what the amendment.
No, not at all. It's not. Well,
What restrictions would be in it?
Well, I'm not going to talk about the specific amendment without pulling it up in front. So I'm not going to do that. But we certainly will be talking about that. And I believe there might be a few other amendments or legislative initiatives on the November ballot in other states, and we'll definitely talk about those in detail before the November election.
I agree. It's not fair for me to ask you to pull the thing up right away, but yeah, my sense is the argument will be this: will be, do you want any restrictions? Yes or no?
Gotcha. And I'm sure you're right that some people will frame it that way, and I believe
you want to have a say about whether your teen daughter gets an abortion, Mike.
Yeah. Again, now we're getting into what the legislation, what the proposed amendment says, and I'm not going to go there, Jay, because I don't have it in front of me. I don't have a chance to study it. So you keep on trying to pull me in. It's not going to happen.
I'm giving you a soundbite.
We somehow have managed to go a week now without a new Donald Trump indictment. I'm not sure how that's happened, but it has. But fear not. I think next week.
Can I just interject? There's a wonderful Babylon Bee piece that says Donald Trump indicted for mocking U.S. national women's soccer team. But
yeah, I know you love the Bee. Well, but there should be an indictment. I think at least it looks like there's going to be an indictment probably next week, the week after. Folks might recall that down in Georgia, Fulton County DA Fannie Willis is reportedly at least planning to ask for indictments on various charges related to Trump's actions regarding the 2020 election in that state. But that is for next week or possibly the week after. But we do have some developments in the current Donald Trump indictments. Like, for instance, just yesterday, Judge Tanya Chutkan rejected the prosecution's request for essentially a blanket protective order that would have really severely restricted the information about the case that Trump and his legal team could share with those not directly involved in the case. But it's sort of a limited victory, if you will, because she agreed to place sensitive materials under a protective order and essentially giving the prosecution a good amount of leeway in defining what is and isn't sensitive. And while it's less than Smith wanted, I'd say that the judge made it clear that Trump simply can't spout off. I mean, at one point she told his attorneys, "I caution you and your client to take special care in your public statements about this case. I'll take whatever measures are necessary to safeguard the integrity of these proceedings." And also she warned Trump's lawyers that she expected the defense to happen in the courtroom, not in the media. She said that if Donald Trump is to look at any of these discovery materials, he can't take his cell phone in there. He can take notes, but his attorneys have to check the notes to ensure that there's nothing that's sensitive that's in the notes. And he certainly can't just take any papers away with him. So there are a lot of restrictions there. Well, let's start with that. What do you think about the judge's decision on the protective order?
So, you know, as a matter of course, protective orders are pretty run of the mill in courts and federal court stuff. What is not run of the mill is that when one of the subjects is a former president and current presidential candidate. And that's where I think the problem lies is I think the judge is correct. If this was a normal defendant, meaning sort of most anybody other than Donald Trump, I think this would make perfect sense. Since it is Donald Trump, there's just inherently problems with it. And I'm not sure how you get around them, right? Just because you want to say, well, listen, we don't want this process to be political. Well, when you're essentially trying to imprison the former president and current presidential candidate, there's no way it's not political. He's not just any other defendant. When you want to say, we don't want you making statements to the media. Well, it's one thing if that's just your run of the mill, embezzler or drug dealer or something like that. It's another thing when, hey, I'm running for president. Not just I've, put my name in and I'm running for president. This is my sort of legal defense, but I am the front runner in the primary of a major party. So I think all those issues are problematic, and we'll see what happens.
Let me ask you, would you agree?
Donald Trump is not the kind of guy who would simply say, no, I'm going to stop saying stuff.
Well, would you agree? It makes it even more challenging given Donald Trump's history of making public statements that certainly feel arguably like witness intimidation, right? I mean, that in a sense, Donald Trump's own actions, as in so many other instances, make life harder for himself, right? Because when you have, you know, all caps, if you come after me, I'm coming after you. Well, I mean, that was part of Smith's request for that Truth Social post, was literally he cut and pasted a picture of it and put it in the request for the protective order saying, listen, this is the guy we're dealing with. And I think that's a fair statement, because it's certainly not much of a stretch to see Donald Trump saying, hey, this person is going to testify against me. Just wanted to let you know this person is an awful human being. It's a subhuman animal who's going to hell. And, you know, here at Trump's, I mean, if I'm a potential witness, that definitely has a chilling effect, given what I've seen.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I think you can draw lines between speech and conduct that crosses the line into potential witness tampering versus statements of this is all a big political witch hunt. Vote for me. Right.
Right. Yeah. Those are more general statements.
I mean, you can agree or disagree on the merits of that statement. But I think that's a perfectly legitimate statement and an important statement for someone to be able to make. Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, I think that's going to be, you know, where the rubber hits the road. And I think what's going to happen is there will be sort of a line testing, right? Trump will start saying stuff and see how far he can get until the prosecution.
Yeah, definitely.
Calls him on it. And then we get it called back in front of the judge. And, you know, I think that's the way it'll play out.
Yeah, that makes I totally agree with you there. Absolutely. And, you know, I wanted to ask kind of more further out stuff like. Donald Trump.
But I mean, here's the thing. I mean, I think it's when you get into the things of saying this witness is a horrible human being and an absolute liar. It's one thing, you know, again, to make those statements in the press in a typical case. I think the A court can say, no, you know, this is you shouldn't be tried in the media. This should be tried in the court. But again, it's quite another thing if you are a political candidate and someone is making statements against you, because, you know, you now, I suppose if you're smart, if you're Trump, your response is, I believe this is all nonsense and I will be vindicated in court. But that's just not his way of doing it. And it's, you know, I'm not sure that his supporters want to hear that. They want to hear this is, you know, terrible, horrible person. And even so, like if you're like a Trump translator, right? And you typed in the, President Trump, here's what we think you ought to say. Say, listen, this witness's statements were entirely false, and I look forward to be vindicated in court. You run it through the Trump translator, it comes out, this is a terrible, horrible person. Many people are saying this. That's just his vernacular. I think it's when you're someone in the public eye, public sphere, running for office, the most important office, you would argue that there ought to be some ability to fight back politically. I'm thinking back to like the Nixon checkers speech, right?
That dope. The idea of comparing. I can't say I've committed the memory big swaths of that speech, but I'm very familiar with that speech and comparing what Nixon did
for the younger members of our audience.
Almost everyone Nixon, younger than us. Yeah.
Yeah. Had been, this is when he was vice president to Eisenhower. Had been accused of corruption in various forms of accepting gifts and so forth. And one of this was this dog puppy checkers. He sort of, you know, went on the air and gave this impassioned speech about, you know, what a great dog checkers was. this was sort of ridiculous and so forth. But what I'm saying is that's an example of a politician who is responding publicly to public accusations of wrongdoing. Whether you think it's, you know, whether you agree or not on the merits, I think it's a legitimate response.
You mean like a checker sort of thing, as opposed to a Donald Trump knowingly?
I think it's a legitimate move What I'm saying is I
guess I'm trying to, I'm trying to understand.
I don't think a political.
I don't understand what you're saying here. I guess I understand you're saying that presidential candidates and really anyone has a right, as a First Amendment right, to make various claims, including, you know, claims that they may even know to be
absolutely false claims.
Yeah. Like, for instance, I mean, Donald Trump this last week said, you know, there's no way I can get a fair trial with the judge, in quotes, assigned to this case, right? With clearly implying that, you know, this was a fixed process and that, hey, he has the right to do that. But to me, the issue, that's not the issue. Now, maybe he wants to make it the issue, but the issue is doing things that would qualify as witness intimidation.
Right. No, I think that's what I'm saying is I agree with you on that. And it's just a question of where that line gets drawn.
Sure. And I agree with you that Donald Trump will test that line. And I would not be surprised if he starts naming names or names one or two and is called back in the court and there are actions that are maybe taken. You know,
my point was, I think it's bad for democracy to say, to have a court limit a politician's ability to respond to criticism, right?
Yeah, but is that what's happening here? I don't think it is.
Not yet. No, not yet. I'm just saying those are my two concerns. Those are the two competing values, right? One, the integrity of the judicial process. Two, the ability for politicians to speak their mind in the campaign.
Okay, because it's, I mean, even Donald Trump's attorneys in their response to Smith's request for a blanket protective order agreed that sealed grand jury testimony, sealed search warrants, and
that kind of stuff's obviously off limits, and it always has been.
But that doesn't matter, I don't think, to Donald Trump. If Donald Trump knows a name, I can totally see him just blasting it out on Truth Social. That is, you know, and that's.
But you wouldn't need it. You wouldn't need a new protective order for grand jury testimony.
Right. I see what you're saying, because that's already.
That's protected. Already covered by statute.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha. And so let me ask you this. Let's say, and I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility, that Donald Trump gets access some way through to names of people who are witnesses, whether it was grand jury testimony or sealed warrants or what have you. And he puts those names out on Truth Social saying, you know, Bob Smith is a horrible person, is going to testify. Bob Smith, I'm coming to get you. What exactly, what is the recourse there? What can Jack Smith, the prosecutor, do or ask to be done in that case? In that instance,
I think in that case, he could go to the court and ask for an injunction to enforce the protective order. And seek whatever remedies are available. And I'll confess again, because I'm not a criminal law expert. Whatever remedies would be available in cases of witness intimidation or witness tampering.
Well, I hope it doesn't come to that, but it would not surprise me if it does come to that, for sure, given what we know about
I guess this is where I think we're not disagreeing, but I think there's a line between X person is a horrible person, he's a liar, he's going to testify against me, go get him, versus these guys are all a bunch of crooks who are out to get me.
Yeah. I mean, it is tough to know when it's exactly witness intimidation, right? But the problem is, if you have a bunch of fanatical followers who are, you know, who take messages and hear them as sort of dog whistles and say, oh my God, you know, I mean, like with the Mike Pence thing, right? Donald Trump says stuff about Mike doesn't have the courage to do this. And next thing you know, there are, you know, fake scaffolds and
you mean we should hang him?
Yeah, exactly. And so when does that, how do you factor in the sort of extremism and craziness of a certain number of supporters? And when making those statements, does Donald Trump know that? And there's a lot going on here, basically, and it's difficult. So while I am sympathetic to free speech claims, for sure, and I think when you err, you need to err on the side of that, I also think that Donald Trump, as always, presents a unique and difficult set of problems in this regard. So,
indeed he does.
All right, let's move on to something different. Late this week, President Biden requested that Congress approve a $40 billion funding package that would include an additional $20.6 billion in funding for Ukraine, $13 billion or so of that would be in the form of additional military funding. They're also asking for another $12 billion to resupply U.S. federal disaster coffers and more funding for enforcement at the southern border. And focusing on the Ukraine funding, to give you a sense, to date, the U.S. has provided Ukraine with over $60 billion in aid. More than $40 billion of that was military funding. And I think tying the Ukraine money to things like domestic disaster aid, border enforcement, that's almost certainly designed to attract a certain amount of bipartisan support. And I think that's important because public support for military aid to Ukraine has been softening. That Ukrainian forces somewhat bogged down in that counteroffensive they've been doing for a while. And I think it remains to be seen if the administration can even get the necessary votes, especially in the House. The Senate, I think, is less of a concern to sustain what are Ukraine's efforts to kind of push back the Russian invasion. And I mention that because, for instance, Kevin McCarthy has previously said he's not going to support additional supplemental funding for Ukraine, and that any money for Ukraine will have to go through the regular appropriations process. And that definitely puts McCarthy at odds with Senate leadership on both sides of the aisle. I mean, both Schumer and McConnell have said that that bipartisan debt ceiling deal won't prohibit Congress from considering supplemental funding for Ukraine. And so I don't know where this is going, but I certainly for a while have been concerned about particularly the House abandoning Ukraine and just saying no more. What do you think, Jay? Do you think this is the beginning of the end for U.S. military support for Ukraine?
No, I don't think. I think House Republicans will make some noises about this, will grouse about it a little bit. But I think it goes through.
I guess what I'm wondering is, I expect the Freedom Caucus, which is a sizable caucus, I think something like, I want to say a quarter, something like that, of Republicans in the House, that I can't imagine that they won't push for a standalone vote on Ukraine funding. And given, like I said, the polling data, to give folks a sense, CNN did a poll that came out just in early August, just a week ago or so, that 55% of respondents said Congress shouldn't authorize more funding to Ukraine. And when you break that down on partisan lines, 71% of Republicans said there shouldn't be any new funding. If I'm a Republican member of Congress and I look at those numbers, especially in the context of an administration request, a Democratic administration request, that I feel puts me on some pretty solid electoral ground, even if I'm not a Freedom Caucus Republican. And so that's why I wonder if maybe this isn't the beginning of the end. So that's what is the background of my thinking on this.
I think that McCarthy is smart enough and talented enough to get the votes or to see that there are enough votes to get this through. Again, there doesn't have to be, you only have to have a couple people take a walk, a couple people across the aisle and it gets there. And I think, as I've said like a million times before, I think there's a great case on the merits to be made. One of the things that I have been pleasantly surprised by the Biden administration was that we've stood by Ukraine. My criticism on Ukraine policy is that we haven't done enough. So, but that's, as you know, that's me, the old Cold Warrior talking.
I wanted to ask you about that.
Maybe that's a lot out of touch with current reality, but I don't think it is. And I think there are a lot of folks who will, can be made to see the geostrategic wisdom of this.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about, because I think I certainly agree with you. And back when both you and I were Republicans, that the idea that over 70% of people in our party would say, no, I'm against additional funding to push back Russian forces who've invaded another country. That would just be
damn pinko hippie.
Yeah, that would be inconceivable. Yeah, exactly. Right. And yet, and this is, I guess this is the question I have for you. How did your party get to a point where, like I said, in this poll, and this isn't like some kind of outlier, 71% of Republicans said, nope, no new funding for Ukraine. 59% said the U.S. has done enough to help Ukraine. And it's just the reverse practically for Democrats. What's going on here with your GOP on this issue?
I think some of it has become such a partisan thing of it's better to see Biden take a loss and let Putin have a win.
Wow.
Right.
That's scary.
Well, it is. I mean, it isn't. I mean, there's the thought is, look, this is Biden's war. This is, and I think this is misguided. But if you're asking me to try to get into the heads.
Yeah, exactly. Folks,
now, look, I think there is always a legitimate argument to be made to say, should we have more oversight? Is the money being spent correctly? You know, all that kind of stuff. Right. I think those are arguments that you always ought to have, the whole like no blank check. Yeah. But I think when you look at the reality of this, right, of when you're in any war, in the Cold War, there's always going to be waste, loss, and abuse, right? There are always going to be allies who may be a little unsavory. Where it was, was F.W. de Klerk a great guy? No. Was Ferdinand Marcus a great guy? No, hardly.
We could go on. The Shah of Iran. Yeah, I mean, there's a huge list. Absolutely.
But yeah, that as Lyndon Johnson had said of Diem, I think, he may be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. And I think that's where we ought to look of whatever claims or arguments you might have about the Ukrainian corruption in the Ukrainian regime, which I think may be well legitimate. When we get down to this geopolitical calculation, it's much more in our interest that the Russians lose, and Putin in particular lose, than it is, making sure that things aren't corrupt. Now, that's not to say that we simply abandon ourselves to corruption or something like that, or say no oversight necessary ever. But I'm kind of like, where's Henry Kissinger when you need him?
That obviously could get us into a whole other debate. Back when things were a little bit reversed, certainly a lot of folks on the left would say that whole attitude of, well, he may be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch,
right,
kind of
right.
ended up causing a lot
we got to cut ties to South Africa and so forth. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a whole other argument. But I certainly would love to see. This is obviously an area where I agree much more with the Mitch McConnells and the Kevin McCarthys, and certainly the America First. And this is, I should point out, kind of an historical.
It's a weird trend that, it's nothing even new. It's ebbs and flows throughout the past 250 years.
Yeah, I mean, and you take a look historically, right, the Republican Party, reluctant to get into World War II, the Republican Party, I think, is historically been much more isolationist. I mean, there's a reason why kind of America First nativism sort of fits in with that. But there was this big gap during the Cold War because the anti-Soviet sort of thing overrode a lot of that. But with that kind of gone, I would argue with it just basically back in a different guise when we're talking about China and Russia. You know, it's unfortunate that the mainstream, or that so many Republican voters have been, I feel, just disastrously misled by these isolationist America Firster folks who have taken over control of the party, at least temporarily.
Yeah. Well, I think part of it, if you look back after Pearl Harbor and then the beginnings of the Cold War, there was a realization that you couldn't simply not be part of the world. Right. And I think that was one of, to me, it's one of the big historical lessons that, you always learn is Munich, right? You can't appease certain people. If you give them an inch, they will take miles and most of a continent. And that was sort of the thinking, right? That was the thinking behind containment. That look, maybe we can't beat them or roll them back, but at least we can hold the line where it is. And I think that's still correct. I think that same rationale applies to Putin as it did to Soviet communism. Look, there's ideological differences built into it,
but I think a much more compelling argument in today's Republican Party, at least, is, you know what, that's Europe's problem. Let them take care of their own business. We're doing just fine. And of course, you and I both agree that that's just disastrously short-sighted. But there you go. Let's hope that that kind of fever passes from the Republican Party at some point in the very near-term future. We can agree on that. All right. Well, before we go today, I don't know if I did this last time, but if I didn't, sorry about that. I wanted to thank Kyle, who's a longtime supporter. Kyle recently increased his support for the show. We really do appreciate that. And one of the things, of course, you get if you increase your support. Later on today, Jay and I, joined by Trey, are going to be recording a listener participation episode, which is open for our Patreon supporters at the $10 and above per month level, where you get to be part of the conversation, ask your questions, comments. It's kind of a fun thing. Jay, you and I have done a few of those, and we're doing today a little later on.
Yell at me in real time.
There you go. Exactly.
Shut up, you idiot. Yeah.
So, yeah, we're doing this one at recording it at noon Eastern time. So that way West Coast listeners won't have to get up at some ungodly hour, that sort of thing. So we're trying that out. But anyway, there's a lot of cool stuff at different levels of support, and we really do appreciate it. And there's our Discord group, which is always a lot of fun, very interesting. I certainly enjoy it. To find out about any of that stuff, you can go to patreon.com/politicsguys. You can also support us on Venmo at politicsguys, and you can support the show through PayPal. You can find all that in the show notes, as well as at politicsguys.com/support. And one of the bonuses, of course, you get if you're a supporter is ad-free versions of everything we put out and the full midweek show, not just the preview, shorter version. But we know that some folks would like to get that full midweek show. You're not in a position financially to support the show. That's totally not a problem. I'm happy to get that show to you. Just send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will get that set up for you. And whether you're a supporter or not, it definitely helps us a lot if you can get the word out through social media or other means by sharing a show, subscribing, rating, or review us in whatever podcast app you use. We really appreciate it if you can take a second to do that. And finally, as always, a very special thanks goes out to our wonderful executive producers of the show, Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, Don Oglesby, and Ivan English. We'll be back with a new episode for you next week. We hope you'll join us.